We're talking about the teacher shortage on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. K-12 schools across the country have reported difficulty in hiring teachers. And now there's new analysis of federal data that finds the shortage is even more acute than previously thought, especially when you factor in things like experience in the classroom and certifications and training. Teachers, are you feeling the shortage at your school, or did you want to be a teacher but decided against pursuing the profession? What made you turn away? You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Emma Garcia is an economist with the Economic Policy Institute, where she researches the economics of education and education policy. Her most recent report looks at the teacher shortage, and she joins us from NPR's studios in Washington, D.C. Emma, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning.
Well, you say the only direct estimate we currently have for the size of this teacher shortage nationally comes from a 2016 report from the Learning Policy Institute. Can you tell us what we actually know about the shortage?
Sure. So, as you say, it's very complicated to come up with an estimate or to produce an estimate of the imbalance between the number of teachers that are needed in a particular year due to vacancies that need to fill to be filled in, due to new openings, and the number of teachers who are available to be hired. So, as you were mentioning, the current most accurate and precise estimate of the magnitude of the problem is the one produced by the Learning Policy Institute in their 2016 report. That had been for following those imbalances, the teacher shortage since a couple of decades ago, and had projected them up to 2025. In the current school year, the imbalance was estimated at about 110,000 teachers missing in the classrooms.
So we've, you know, over a handful of years have been growing the shortage, 20,000 in 2012 to 2013, moving up to 64,000, you know, just a couple years later. And then now you say we're at $110,000. You know, is a shortage hard to measure, to get your arms around?
It is, and the reason is that there are very many factors involved in that gap, in that imbalance. We have to look into the factors that contribute to the demand for new teachers, and we have to look into the factors that contribute to the supply of new teachers. Behind any of those trends, there are very multiple reasons and factors, and therefore coming up with an estimate that compares the two trends is very complicated. And we thank the Learning Policy Institute for having done that analysis.
And so you are writing about that this shortage is probably more severe than we had previously thought or recognized. What did you look at when you say that this is much more acute? What are some of those things that are popping out to you?
Sure. So technically, the estimate that the Learning Policy Institute provided us with is the exact measurement of the magnitude of the shortage. What we did in this research was to ask ourselves, using that estimate as a departure, we asked ourselves what the number would be if we thought of whether all students are taught by teachers with the qualifications linked to being an effective teacher. That's one. And the second dimension was to think of whether the problem is more acute in some settings than in others, in some schools than in other schools.
Talking with Emma Garcia, she's an economist with the Economic Policy Institute, and she researches the economics of education and education policy. And her most recent report looks at the teacher shortage. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you want to be a teacher but decided against it? What was it, the pay, the workplace environment, uncertainty around the profession? What would you have needed in order to stay on track to become a teacher? You can call in or email ideas at WPR.org. Emma, using data from the Department of Education, you found that the number of teachers without certain credentials has also increased since the 2011-2012 school year. Can you tell us about the credentials you're looking at?
Yes. So in this, to identify the qualifications linked with being an effective teacher, according to research, according to the evidence that tell us what qualifications or credentials teachers should have, we look into the share of teachers who are fully certified, the share of teachers who have more than 5 years of experience, the share of teachers who have a background in the subject of main assignment, and also the share of teachers who have followed a traditional route into teaching.
And that's pretty concrete. Those are pretty concrete thresholds that you have to meet in order to be able to say, yes, you are you meet these standards, or no, you don't. I mean, those seems to be pretty clear cut.
Some are clearer than others. For example, having a standard certificate, an advanced certificate, that's a very clear cut. You either have it or not. For experience, we know that the relationship between teacher experience, experience in the profession, and your effectiveness as teacher is not linear. So it's harder. We know that on average, we can say that teachers with more than 5 years of experience are more effective than teachers with fewer years of experience, which doesn't mean that a very young teacher who just came on board to the profession is not effective. It means that his effectiveness will increase. Most likely with his tenure within the school.
So what is causing fewer teachers to enter the profession in the first place, and what's causing fewer qualified teachers to go into teaching?
So you were mentioning a few of the reasons why we see a decreasing number of incoming teachers in the profession. The two most troubling dynamics in the teacher labor markets have to do with an excessive number of teachers quitting the profession or moving across schools, and a decreasing number of teachers being available to be hired. And that comes from mainly two factors. One is the one you were asking me about, the number of new teachers, the number of people who complete an education program, training program, and the number of teachers who moved from a different school and are still willing to be in the profession. The reasons for the divergence of the number of teachers needed in a year and the number of teachers available to be hired are very diverse. They go from low pay, tough working conditions, disrespect in society, lack of policy, attention to how we could have better and stronger teachers, lack of supports in the schools, and I could go on and on for a long time.
We're talking about a new study out of the Economic Policy Institute, and economist Emma Garcia crunched federal data, concluded that a nationwide teacher shortage is very real, and it impacts high-poverty schools the most. You can join in with your experience at 800-642-1234. Are you a teacher and feeling like this hits home to you? Is your school staving off a shortage for now? Is a lack of teachers affecting the classroom experience? Perhaps you really wanted to be a teacher but decided against it. What turned you off? Call in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue this conversation in just a moment on the Ideas Network. We're looking at what's contributing to a nationwide teacher shortage here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Economic Policy Institute is publishing a series of papers analyzing the conditions that contribute to the shortage of high-qualified teachers. And their analysis is coming out at a time when we're seeing teachers around the country protesting low wages. Are you a teacher? Have you been one for decades? What changes have you seen anecdotally in the new teachers coming into the profession? Did you train to be a teacher, then leave after a short time? What would you have needed in order to stay? We're at 800-642-1234. Tweet us WPR Mornings. Emma Garcia is our guide. She is an economist at the Economic Policy Institute based in Washington, D.C. Let's go to the phones now with Dan joining us from Cumberland. Hi, Dan.
Good morning, Kate. Cumberland's way up north. Northwestern rural district, you know, and I have noticed, I've been a teacher for 23 years. Since Act 10 took place, I have noticed a significant decrease in qualified applicants up in our little school district. And the quality of the applicants has also gone down, the ones we've gotten. And even to the point where we've had positions in the past where we couldn't get anybody, and we had to go out to another school district and try to recruit experienced teachers. And I'm just wondering if our guest in her study had any, you know, anything to say about the political environment that teachers are in, especially in Wisconsin.
Thanks, Dan, for the call. Emma, Dan is talking about their Act 10 that in 2011, former Governor Walker passed Act 10, which reduced collective bargaining rights for public sector unions. Do you see an impact there?
That's a very important question, the one Dan was raising. This analysis in particular is just a descriptive analysis that looks into the federal data from 2011, 2012, and 2015, 2016. So we do not have analysis by state, unfortunately. It's not possible to do that type of analysis with the most recent data. It will be possible in a few months when the new teacher and schools data becomes available. But of course, a descriptive analysis represents the reality. It doesn't explain why, it doesn't explain how much the political environment affects, but it notes what the current situation is as a result of all those political environment decisions, etc. The underfunding, the fight against teachers, the lack of respects. Of course, a descriptive analysis is going to reflect, though not explain or disentangle, the consequences of those attacks to teachers.
Yeah, and disentangle it. But do we know at all how teachers' unions affect the quantity and quality of teachers we have? Can we make any links there?
We could make links, for example, but they would be links that connect unions with another measure, and then with shortages. What we know, for example, is how sensitive the teacher supply is to pay, for example. And we know that unions are very powerful and very helpful in raising teacher salaries. Therefore, we can make an indirect connection between the size of the teacher shortage, the quality of the teachers, and the strength of unions.
What types of schools are suffering the most from a shortage of teachers, both in the quantity of teachers and in quality?
So it's a singular response. It's one type of schools only. It's the high poverty schools. In our analysis, we describe or we identify high poverty schools as those schools that serve larger shares of low-income students. Our cutoff is at 50% of free and reduced lunch students. That's the type singular of schools that suffers the most from this problem, as it does with many other educational problems.
And you say that these teachers who work in high-poverty schools are less likely to say they plan on continuing in this profession. Why is that?
Because a myriad of reasons. Because opposite to what we would believe, they are paid less. because their working environment is more challenging, because they are more underfunded, because you could follow, go on and on and on and on.
So there are a lot of these factors in building up for these teachers in high poverty schools. Is pay universally an issue across school districts, wealthy and high poverty?
It is, yes.
And so when we see these low wages, are some schools able to find different ways to either boost wages or make a healthier environment to, make up for the shortcomings at all?
Let me share with all of you why low pay is an issue. On average, teachers are paid 18% less than comparable individuals who are not teachers. That is a very heavy cut in the paycheck for somebody willing to pursue a profession versus another. That's a very heavy cut in the paycheck. In Wisconsin, that cut is even heavier. It's about 22%. That's why low pay with respect to similarly educated individuals in other professions is an issue. It really is.
Talking with Emma Garcia, she's an economist with the Economic Policy Institute, where she researches the economics of education and education policy. And her most recent report looks at the teacher shortage and where it's coming from. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Schools, are you feeling the shortage where you are? How is it impacting your school and the way students are educated? What do you think the solution is? And parents, we want to hear from you as well. What are you seeing? How has this affected your child? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So in your study, you write that the teacher shortage hurts the profession's reputation as a whole. How can a lack of a certain type of worker impact a career in this way?
So it's very important. The lack of highly credentialed peers in a school, the teacher shortage, has very many consequences on many rounds. But it, for example, it alters the cohesion of the school. It reduces teachers' effectiveness. It affects teachers' morale. The consequences of all these factors together makes it more difficult to build a solid reputation for teaching. It makes it more complicated for incoming teachers to be willing to join those schools that are short by a number of teachers. It forces teachers staying in the schools to, for example, face larger enrollments per class, because when a school, as Dan was saying, is unable to fill in a vacancy, the school still needs to serve the students who are enrolled, and one way to do that is by increasing class size, for example. So instead of helping, it just adds another ingredient that makes the job much more challenging.
Emma, one of the things about any profession is feeling like you can grow and develop in the job, that you're not just doing the same thing and not learning and growing as a human. What about professional development support? How does that play a role?
That's one of the topics that our series will cover in a few weeks. What we found around professional development is that the opportunities are spotty and are not necessarily well targeted. So the professional development opportunities that teachers have access to are sometimes driven by the type of school, the resources the school has, and that's for teachers who have been in the profession for multiple years. But we also find a lack of early support, lack of opportunities to participate in teacher induction programs, for example, for the youngest teachers. So altogether, the lack of early career supports and professional development opportunities is also something that explains why fewer teachers want to stay in the profession, fewer individuals want to go into teaching, and why the challenges schools are facing in order to fill in a vacancy have increased over time.
We're talking with Emma Garcia of the Economic Policy Institute. She's walking us through her findings as she looks at the teacher shortage. Getting your thoughts as well, 800-642-1234. Teachers and administrators, what do you think needs to be done to recruit and retain the best and brightest teachers? Does your district struggle to keep talented teachers in the classroom? And how has your district worked through the teacher shortage challenges? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back after a news update on the Ideas Network. We're looking at the challenge in filling teacher positions. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to Gallup, the supply of teachers has been in decline for at least a decade, and fewer teachers are entering teacher preparation programs, with a decline from more than 700,000 enrollments in 2010 to fewer than 500,000 in recent years. So we're talking about this new study out of the Economic Policy Institute that's tracing where this shortage stems from, and your insights are welcome at 800-642-1234. Principals and superintendents, what challenges and what changes have you made in your district to recruit and retain talented teachers? Do you find yourself in competition with other districts around the state that may lure your top talent away? And how do you deal with this? New teachers, is this a career that you will stick with? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. Economist Emma Garcia stays with us from the Economic Policy Institute. Emma, what do we know, and concretely, how this is all affecting students, how the shortage is impacting our students?
So this is a very important point. We know from existing research as well that the teacher shortage depresses student performance. In addition to what I mentioned before of reducing teachers' effectiveness and altering the cohesion and affecting teachers' morale, it ends up being important for student performance. We also know that these consequences persist over time, so it's very worrisome that we are not able to attract and retain the strongest, the greatest teachers in the classrooms. It seems to us, according to what the data says, what the research says, that the prestige of teaching, when teaching is such an important profession, has just been ignored and damaged over the years.
Let's take a call now. Let's go to Jeremy joining us from Racine. Good morning, Jeremy.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I guess the question I'm having here is when you look at the cost of a four-year degree to be qualified to be a teacher, plus you got to take additional classes to get your teacher certification, are teachers looking at it like it's just the costs are too high for such an education level for, say, a K through 12 education teaching? Are the student loans becoming such a burden in the cost of it that they're looking at other professions to get into versus a low-paying wage of, say, $30,000, $36,000 a year job as a public teacher?
Emma, what is the impact of a four-year baccalaureate degree and then going into a low-paying profession?
That's a very important question that people who have made those decisions know very well how challenging it is to repay the loans in general, but how much harder it is when your capacity to repay is reduced by the substantial amount that we were saying. It is not the same to repay out of a salary in a college level occupation than in teaching if your salary is 18% lower. That's a very important venue for policy interventions, and it's been suggested that in order to improve the attraction of new teachers, to improve retention of teachers, that some assistance to the loans, to the capacity to repay student loans, etc., could be improved for those who make the decision of pursuing a teaching career.
Well, Jeremy, I want to ask you a little bit more about your perspective. Are you a teacher or affiliated with the profession at all?
My wife is currently seeking a teaching certification right now, but she's not looking at for the K through 12. As much money she's already invested in her education, she's got a two-year associate. She's looking at a route for the public tech college to help assist in paying for the remaining 2 years mm-hmm. of her education. So that's kind of like part of a program that she's trying to get into. But she needs to go get her certification and then go from there, and then the schools will help assist in paying for her further education. That might be an opportunity that public school systems around the state of Wisconsin could promote. Those with two-year associates who are interested in becoming a teacher, we can help assist you obtain the last 2 years of education financially if you're interested in coming to our school districts. That might be an option for a solution for a teacher shortage in our public school system.
Emma, are you seeing solutions like that around the country?
It's one of the areas where there's been some action. There are some districts that do offer some financial aid in order to help these cases. It's just, listening to Jeremy, it's just so sad to hear that people who are interested in being a teacher, as he was saying, decide not to because of the lack of financial support in the first place, and that it's something that is built on over the years, because obviously the wealth and the savings a teacher can accumulate, if any, are much lower than what they could accumulate in other professions. It's just sad that we are keeping teachers who are motivated, individuals who are motivated to go into the classrooms away due to these reasons and lack of policy interventions and political interest.
Well, are there any policy interventions that could help bump teacher pay, or that could specifically address teacher pay? What are those interventions? What would they look like?
So I would say there are two main ways to go about teacher pay. One is to go about teacher pay universally, and that would follow the proposal Senator Harris made about 10 years ago. She offered to raise teacher pay by about $13,000 on average if she becomes president.
Kamala Harris.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. And that would be sort of a universal solution to low teacher pay, which is a universal problem for all teachers. And other ways that have been used have to do with thinking about incentive systems, thinking about paying some teachers more than others, introducing bonuses. It's called the merit pay strategy. Research is not showing that that's going to be the solution. Small buckets of attention and creating those distortions in addition to the incentives doesn't sound to be the solution to a universal problem.
Let's circle back to high-poverty schools for a moment. What about those school environments? How can we change the tougher environment that teachers may face in those schools and make them a place where teachers won't be burned out? They will find joy in their job.
The main solution for that is to increase school funding and to make it really equitable. We still have some states that have not recovered their pre-recession per-student spending. It's about 25 states that haven't recovered the spending from the years prior to the recession. That is a very significant problem. And we also know that given the characteristics of the funding of the education, inequities exist. And unless you are able to address those inequities with funding that compensates for the lack of funding in those schools, that compensates for other additional challenges that high schools have, you are not going to improve the equity of the system, and you are not going to provide equal opportunities to all your children.
Well, Emma, if you can look into your crystal ball or forecast in any way from the numbers that you currently have, if nothing is done to address this shortage, how much of a bigger problem could this be?
Unfortunately, I could not be optimistic about it. First of all, we do have, going back to the beginning of our conversation, we have the projection from the Learning Policy Institute, but we also know that education is going to be still very intensive in the use of human capital. It's going to be very demanding in terms of offering wider curriculums to replace teachers who will be retiring in the next decade, where policies will still increase the demand for teachers because class sizes will be asked to be shrinked. So it doesn't seem to me, unfortunately, that unless we tackle all the problems and all the circumstances that explain why we have a teacher shortage in the first place, that have to do with pay, that have to do with school climate, that have to do with lack of professional development, that have to do with the lack of funding, I don't think we are going to see a smaller problem in the future, but the opposite.
Emma, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Emma Garcia is an economist with the Economic Policy Institute. She researches the economics of education and education policy. And her most recent report looks at the teacher shortage. She joined us from NPR studios in Washington. Coming up, we're exploring our friendships, and we want to hear from you. What is the role of friendship in your life? Have you made a friend in an unusual way? We're at 800-642-1234. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking friendships on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The great Roman philosopher Cicero wrote that an old friendship, like a fine wine, becomes more delightful with the passage of time. And Cicero's best friend was Atticus back in the first century BC. And even though they were often apart, Cicero and Atticus exchanged letters that revealed a warm and devoted friendship. Do you have a good friendship story? Did you meet a friend in an unexpected way? We're at 800-642-1234. Julie Beck is a senior editor at The Atlantic, where she covers family and education. And her new series on friendship is called The Friendship Files. Julie, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
You talked to a bunch of different people for this series, to women who met through their work as co-pastors in a church, friends who met as contestants on the Great British Bake Off, and a group of men who were soldiers in the Vietnam War. First of all, how did you find these friendships?
Yeah, so some of them, you know, the Great British Bake Off ones, I just like that show, and it occurred to me to try to find them. Some of them were sort of referred to me by friends or friends of friends who knew of, you know, interesting stories. And now we just have an email, friendshipfiles@theatlantic.com, where people can submit stories if they want to nominate themselves or nominate someone they know. And so we're getting a lot that way as well.
You were worried that these friendship stories would be mundane after a while, or that the same things would be coming out profile after profile. Are you wrong?
I'm often wrong. So it wasn't that, you know, I thought they would be mundane necessarily. It's just that I didn't know how long this series could be going on, right? You know, how many different profiles we could do, or how long we could kind of stretch it out. And so I always sort of wondered, you know, sometimes just in the course of doing journalism, as I'm sure you know, you do an interview and it's just not your best. And I wondered, you know, every time I made another call, like, is this going to be the one that just doesn't work out for whatever reason? Like, we just can't use it. And so far that has not been the case. You know, every time I talk to the friends together, you know, I interview them on a conference call. And I think that helps, because when people are talking with their friends and about their friends, they're just consistently, you know, warm and funny and generous. And you can hopefully capture a little bit of that dynamic that they have together. And to me, it's just endlessly interesting.
Well, the most recent one you just published, the two friends who work together writing songs for Sesame Street. Can you tell us mm-hmm. about these work colleagues that really spilled over into this really enduring long friendship?
Yeah, they were so interesting. They were working together. Their names are Chris Cerf and Norm Stiles. And Norm was a head writer on Sesame Street, and Chris was a writer and composer. And they were both with Sesame Street from pretty close to the very beginning. And they just, you know, they used to collaborate on songs for the show. They told me they used to go out to this restaurant called Elaine's, which I guess is sort of a famous writer's spot in New York City, and just kind of have martinis and like bounce ideas off each other. And it led to a lot of the sort of famous songs that if people grew up with Sesame Street, they might know, like Put Down the Ducky is like the big example. And they just, you know, because they had this great collaboration at work, it sort of developed into a friendship beyond that as well.
I love how they got each other out of these creative problems that they created out of their songs. Like when the American Dairy Goat Association was sending angry letters to them and how they retaliated. Can you tell us about that?
Sure, I'll try to tell it accurately. So they had like an animation. I think it was just about subtraction. So all these animals were like eating things, and then it would go down to zero, right? And so that's how you're kind of teaching subtraction. And at the end, they had like a goat eating sneakers. And I guess the Dairy Goat Association was upset by that. They didn't want people to think that goats were eating sneakers when they're, you know, eating healthier grasses and corns and whatnot. And so I think it was Norm was saying, well, you know, let me try to just understand their perspective, like very Sesame Street philosophy. and they were like, why don't we just like attach a little puppet goat to the end of the animation who's upset? And he's the dairy goat. And he's saying, you know, we don't eat things like this. We eat healthy foods, not sneakers, da da da. So it was sort of showing both sides within the song, the animation.
Well, tell us about the friends who reconnected after 20 years apart because of a sweater.
Oh my gosh, I love these guys. So yeah, they were best friends growing up in high school in the 90s in New Jersey. And I guess they were going out one night and one of them borrowed the other one's sweatshirt and he never returned it, which who among us? But he kept it for 20 years. He wore it all the time. He like sent me photos of himself, like on his first date with his wife wearing this sweatshirt and all this stuff. And then I guess he was watching the Marie Kondo show and he was like, it's time to declutter my life. And he found the sweatshirt and he was like, you know, I've had this for 20 years. It's not really mine. And his friend, who he hadn't seen in a long time, like lived nearby in the area. And he just texted him and was like, hey, man, I have your sweatshirt. Like, can I give it back to you? So they got together and he returned the sweatshirt. And there was some pomp and circumstance about the whole thing. And it was very sweet.
I was so surprised because these are two friends who were so close in high school. They live 5 miles apart. And yet they have very little interaction, you know, just once in a while. And you ask them about social media. I'm like, don't you guys keep up on social media? And they kind of had a funny response to that.
Oh, did they? I don't remember. I mean, I think I know that one of them was more on social media than the other.
Yeah. But in the sense that, you know, here they are in proximity, they're close. And yet their friendship endures, even though that they may not keep up with each other every day.
Yeah, and I think that's like kind of a defining quality of friendship too, is that, you know, any other relationship, if you don't see somebody for that long, you probably are going to stop considering them. If you're dating somebody and you don't see them for months, you're not really dating anymore, probably. This is a different situation where, you know, friendship is just flexible. And I feel like people often say, you know, we hadn't seen each other in so long, but when we met up, it was just like picking right back up where we left off, and like we'd never been apart. And I think that's something that is pretty unique.
We're talking with Julie Beck. She's a senior editor at The Atlantic, and her new series on friendship is called The Friendship Files. Asking you to about this another story you wrote about two women who met in the comment section of the feminist website Jezebel. How did they end up becoming friends?
Yeah, so that was actually a lot of women. I only spoke with five because there's only so many that you can get on a conference call. But I think the group is about 20 or 25 people now. And yeah, originally it was, you know, they were all in the comment section of Jezebel back in, I want to say the late 2000s. And, you know, just a different era of internet, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is around like 2008, 2009 maybe.
Yeah, that sounds right. And they would have these open threads on Jezebel every day. Like, you know, they would comment on articles and stuff, but Jezebel like was fostering this comment community by just being like, here's an open thread, like go nuts. And so they would just be chatting in there and sharing about their lives. And when the structure of Jezebel kind of changed, or the comment system changed, they moved, you know, they invited all of their like favorite friends from the comment section to like this other forum site, and eventually to Facebook. So now they have a private group on Facebook where they keep in touch, and they've gone on vacation together a bunch of times. Like they went to Dollywood, they went to Las Vegas. Dollywood was the first time that they all met each other in person, instead of just being online friends. And they, you know, they said it was like a really momentous, occasion for them. But now, you know, they're just kind of communicating on all mediums all the time, seeing each other in person when they can. And it's pretty cool.
You write about how we tend to value romantic relationships and family relationships more than we do friendships. And as a result, we spend more time writing and making art about these kinds of relationships. And these friendships fall by the wayside. What do you make of that?
Yeah, so it's true that a lot of my interest in this sort of started from a research perspective, because I used to, and I still do, write quite a bit about the sort of psychological research, sociological research on friendship, of which there is not a lot. And the friendship researchers themselves have told me, like, yeah, if you go to like the relationship, whatever research conference, like friendship has like one table, and mm-hmm. the rest is family, the rest is romantic relationships. And I think that's true for art too, although I don't want to, you know, make a super sweeping statement, because there's been, you know, shows in recent times like Broad City that have gotten into exploring friendship a bit more. But generally, yeah, it is a bit underrepresented, I would say.
Julie, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Julie Beck is a senior editor at The Atlantic, and her new series on friendship is called The Friendship Files. Comes out every Friday. If you have an amazing friendship story, you can submit it. Email friendshipfiles@theatlantic.com. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.